From the Two Buffalo Studios in Bradenton, Florida, welcome to Indigenous in the News. We'll be bringing you the current updates that affect us all, from the Shakers and the Makers in Indian Country. I'm your host, Larry Kay from the Ho-Chunk Nation, along with Gary Wilcox from the Powhatan Nation. On today's show, we welcome from the Eastern Band Cherokee Nation, Mr. Larkin Forkiller, photographer, writer, and entrepreneur. Today, he's here to talk about how to see and learn about nature. Larkin is a professional nature and wildlife photographer. He takes photographs of animals, flowers, landscapes, and waterfalls. He's the owner of Larkin Forkiller Nature Photography. All this and more, but first, the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. Federal officials announced a new round of funding to help tribes access clean drinking water. As Alex Hager reports from the Mountain West News Bureau, that includes nearly $35 million for tribes in Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, and Wyoming.
Across the country, nearly half of all tribal homes do not have access to reliable clean drinking water. This money, which comes from the Inflation Reduction Act, is part of a federal effort to change that. The Ute Mountain Ute tribe in Colorado and the San Carlos Apache tribe in Arizona are among those getting money to plan, build, and maintain pipelines and water treatment plants. The Biden administration says this pool of money will help it stay on track with a goal to give 40% of its climate spending to marginalized communities. This comes as tribes in the Southwest are asking for a bigger say in talks about how to use the Colorado River. They've been largely excluded from negotiations about the river since the earliest days of its management. I'm Alex Hager.
Alaskan winters are some of the coldest winters in the world. With record-breaking snowfalls and temperatures reaching the negatives, Alaskans prepare months ahead of time for the long, cold winter months. For some people, even staying warm becomes a challenge and is the reality for many veterans living in Alaska, including Native veterans. Jesse Lakin is a combat veteran who served two deployments in Iraq. After his service, he moved to Alaska and started volunteering for organizations such as the National Wild Turkey Federation and helped create a nonprofit called Battle Dogs, helping veterans suffering from PTSD and addiction. A few years after Lakin moved to Alaska, he spoke to an Alaska State Trooper who said he had just delivered firewood to a veteran and told him of the dire situation many veterans face in Alaska.
He's responded to four deaths at that point that he knew were veterans, telling me that he was frustrated because there wasn't really anything in place to help seniors with snow removal and firewood. And what we found was veterans like to isolate. They don't have anybody checking on them.
Lakin says the four veterans who died all showed signs of struggle when they were found. They had burned all of their wood furniture, and their oven doors were found open, indicating they tried to warm their homes with the oven. He said he knew he had to do something.
There was no real tracking system here in the state. Nobody's really paying attention to that, and there was no program designed to support them. So we got proactive. We started thinking about how to help, and we created the Matsu Winter Preparedness Project.
The project started out small, with Lakin and some veteran friends reaching out to other veterans to deliver firewood and remove snow from by their home. He soon changed the name to the Alaska Warrior Partnership. Here is Lakin talking about one of his experiences.
When we found him, he was barely moving. He had his dog inside of his jacket, and then I think every piece of clothing on him possible. Hadn't had fire in like 3 days, and it was negative 40 degrees.
But the story has a happy ending.
We provided firewood, we got him warmed up, and then we took him to the hospital, and then we provided him firewood and snow removal for the rest of the winter, and we took care of him and then got him off the program, got him moved into a better house in town.
Lakin says he's responded to many residences in similar situations. More information about the program is posted on the American Warrior Partnership Facebook page. And now for a correction for a story that aired Thursday in which we misidentified a quote in a story about Alaska Representative Mary Peltola's bid for re-election. The quote was not from her opponent, Nick Begich, but his uncle, former U.S. Senator Mark Begich. I'm Jill Freitas.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at AARP.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
From Two Buffalo Studios in Bradenton, Florida, I'm Gary Wilcox. On today's show, we will welcome Larkin Forkiller, writer, photographer, and entrepreneur. Hello, Larkin.
Welcome. Hey, Gary, how are you?
Good. Welcome to the show, Indigenous in the News. It's a pleasure to have you on the show today. Let's start with an introduction.
Hi, Larkin.
Okay. Well, my name is Larkin Forkiller. I'm a professional photographer, and I specialize in nature and wildlife photography. I'm an Eastern Band Cherokee. And I'm a true artist, and that's me.
How did you know it was going to happen this way, being a photographer? Kind of curious.
Well, I'd always been interested in photography as far as, like, documenting things. Like, okay, if you're at a birthday party and, you know, you take pictures of, you know, happy, you know, 20th birthday or things like that, just to mainly kind of preserve time, or you see something that's really cool, you want to photograph it. So I was always around photography, but never did I think of it being like a professional thing. So
sure. Was there an individual that helped you? Anybody give you the inspiration to jump?
No, I was actually, as funny as this may sound, I was never into the arts or the artistry. I mean, okay, I appreciate anything that's great, but that was never really my thing.
Sure.
And just seeing people photograph, I always thought photography was really cool as far as documenting the times and family times and work times and things that were really important. So that was my first, that was kind of my first thinking of photography.
Interesting. Why don't we start with the topic, how to see and learn from nature? I was wondering, you know, when you're walking around out there in the wilderness, what safety concerns do you have to worry about?
Safety, that's a very great question that you ask, but there are a lot of safety concerns that you have to look out for. Like if you're looking at eye level, or you're looking at ground level, or you're looking at the air level. Mm-hmm. But if you're looking down, like at the ground, it's very important to know that, you know, you could run into rattlesnakes, you could run into copperheads, you could run into cottonmouths or water moccasins.
Wow.
And, you know, never mistake good luck for good tactics, or just good luck for you've done the right thing. It's always good to be, I think, overly cautious. And so if you're out and about and you're not paying attention to how you're walking, you could easily, you know, come across a cottonmouth if you're down by the creek, or, you know, a copperhead if you're out by the rocks and you're not paying attention and you, you know, put your hand on a rock or you sit on a rock. You just have to be really aware, or else you won't be able to photograph.
When you're shooting wildlife, do you set up the shoot, or do you hide yourself in the camera? How does that work?
That's a great question, too. And to each their own. I think everyone has a unique style. But for me, I always, one time a news reporter or writer, editor, she had asked me like the same question. And I said that basically to see wildlife, if I just took a step out, we were doing an interview in an art gallery. But I said, if I literally just stepped out the door, right, there's nature photography. Because you're going to probably see a robin, or you're going to see a brown bird, or you'll hear blue jays or things like that. So when I started out, I kind of just went, and I just started going outside and maybe like going to a park or in the neighborhood, or, you know, maybe an hour drive as time got on and things like that. So I always just went with my camera equipment and just with a great attitude, a very happy attitude. And I was able just to photograph. I didn't really have a plan. Right. Not all your outings are like that. But most of my outings, when I started off, I did not have a plan. And so I would learn.
Sure.
I would see a bird, and I would have binoculars, or I have a telephoto lens. So I was able to hear the bird, and it was just cool because I would hear different sounds. Right. And then when you see the bird up close, whether you're with a telephoto lens or you're with binoculars, then you'll actually see another bird. And you can see, oh, I didn't know, but that's a blue jay. Or I didn't know, but that's a northern flicker. Or I didn't know, and that's a killdeer. So when you first start off, or when I first started off, everything was just new. It was fun. It was peaceful. And when I would run across, say, a killdeer or a northern flicker, and there are so many other birds, but it was like the most coolest feeling because it's the first time. And you learn I always enjoyed learning by me learning and not necessarily learning by the book and then going out to learn. And then when I would go back after I learned it through firsthand, I would read about it and I was like, okay, everything fits just as it says.
Do you ever use calls or any sort of whistles or anything like that to sort of attract certain birds to maybe come into a shot?
It's another great question, probably another great idea, but offhand, I actually, you know, like I said, each their own. I really don't like that. I go out there and I am just in nature. I am in peace. I am in their nature, which is our nature too, but we really don't think about that. And so when I'm in the quiet and I go there without a phone, I'm completely into the nature. I'm in that time period that they're in. And so everything is quiet and everything is peaceful. And then they will be there. They will see you. And if they feel a nervous energy from you or you startle them, they will fly away or they will not be there. But if you come there with no time and you come there, curious and like lovingly, that you will be a part of that world where we're all one, to where the landscapes are one, to where the animals and the wildlife are one, and we as humans are one. Yeah. And that right there will bring out everything. I don't, you know, I would not rely on a whistle or a bird call or, but I'm always open.
Yeah. You were mentioning telephoto. Do you ever have to wait a long time for that right shot?
And I'm thinking of one instance to where that's actually happened to me when I very first started. Uh-huh. And I just happened to have my telephoto lens out. And for those who don't know, a telephoto lens is a longer lens. Right. So if something's right in front of me, I wouldn't use a long lens. Mm-hmm. If we're looking at a bird or something that's further away, I would use a long lens. Right. And so there was a time I was just happened to, I think I was leaving or going to another location to shoot some wildlife photography. And it just so happened that it turned out to be an eastern bluebird. Maybe there was a couple, but an eastern bluebird had flown pretty close to me. And I had my telephoto lens out. And I was able to snap some really great pictures and take my time with a telephoto lens. And that picture actually, it's when I very first started, maybe 10 years ago. It was actually entered in the Cherokee Indian Fair, I believe, Cherokee, North Carolina. And it won first place.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So you must carry your camera around at all times. You must pay attention a lot. Do you ever see something you like and then have to do a U-turn? You know, you're driving down the road and all of a sudden, wow, I got to turn around.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Let's say that I'm in the Smoky Mountains.
Sure.
Or it could be out west, you know, in the Colorado terrain.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, well, let's just go back to the Smoky Mountains. You know, that's a long stretch, you know, of Tennessee and a lot of roads and, you know, the traffic doesn't move very fast, which that's great because people want to get out. They want to take pictures. And so that was the case with me is there might be 30 stops within 2 hours that you could pull off on the side of the road and take a picture of the landscape or the mountains. And so you don't necessarily want to pull off 30 different times. You know, you have a time schedule or this, that, and the other. And so, yes, there are times that you want to turn around because should I stop there and not skip that and got a better shot or a better angle or better lighting? So that happens a lot of the times.
Sure. I was thinking about that because a lot of my friends growing up, they always had cameras on and, you know, you see something, you go, hey, you got to turn around, Larry. Yeah. Today, we're speaking with Larkin Fourkiller from the Eastern Band Cherokee. Larkin is a photographer, writer, and entrepreneur. We'll be right back with the rest of our interview.
take it. We all need a second. Thunder redirected. The ether we detected.
Speaking about cameras, today everybody with iPhones and things like that, everybody thinks they're a photographer because of these cameras that they have.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about the equipment that you carry and the way that you take the shot? How do you feel about that versus some of the technology of today?
Well, your smartphones or iPhones or whatever, you know, the people use, they're actually great, I found, for like macro photography. And macro photography is very close-up photography. So if I want to get a really detailed picture of a flower, and there's a lot of different flowers, well, I believe like smartphone works really well in that scenario. But if you're looking at something like a long distance, like a bird or something like that, you can get a decent shot to share with your family and friends. But as far as a professional shot, I would probably say no. So like with everything, there's advantages to each piece of equipment.
Got it. You're from the Cherokee Nation. From ECBI. When you're out there, and you're photographing wildlife, I know a lot of the clans out there have, you know, the Wolf Clan and Deer Clan, things like that. Do you often run into a shot that coincides with, you know, one of those clans, and it makes you think about the shot as you're taking it?
That's a great question. Like you think about Deer Clan or the Hare Clan or the different clans that you're saying, I think the Bird Clan as well. And, you know, forgive me if I don't know all seven of them right off the get go, but, I would say just being like an Eastern Band Cherokee and feeling the area that you're from. I feel like I carry that in my soul. And so it just, it'll translate to the camera and what I look for. But to look for like a specific bird or something like that, like the Eastern Band is big on the spider.
Mm-hmm.
Kananeski, I believe that's how you say that in Cherokee, Kananeski. You know, I don't photograph many spiders or film them. Maybe I should. And I hear of the cardinal a lot. Like if you see the cardinal, it's like a sign of a loved one that's passed on, that's came back to visit you. And with that, as a cardinal, it's been very kind of difficult for me to photograph. Mm-hmm. But it's a very spiritual and very powerful bird. And yeah.
What is your favorite animal to photograph? And is there a species out there that you haven't conquered with your camera? You know, like the ones that hide the best, little ones. I know the big ones can't hide, but the little ones can.
I would say the fox and the coyote would probably be my favorite.
Okay, cool.
To see the coyote, I've only been able to professionally photograph a coyote one time. Very difficult, maybe twice, but the other time was at a distance out west. And the fox, I've been fortunate enough to be able to photograph a lot, but over a stretch of 10 years, you know, I might have photographed it seven different times in that 10-year period. So I got a lot of pictures of the fox, but it isn't like you're going to see the fox enough to take a professional photograph every time you see one. And it is actually kind of rare to see the fox.
Sure. Now, how do you attract them? Or do you just have to wait?
Well, I just actually, in my neighborhood, I just happened to look out my window the other day. And a fox was just strolling along the sidewalk on a late night, just perfectly on the sidewalk and kind of stopping and looking at the houses. And I just thought that was really cool. Not a time where I would professionally photograph the fox, but it was just unique to see that fox just out and about.
Yeah.
Have you ever gotten off the beaten path and found yourself like, completely like out, have lost complete loss of time and ran yourself into say an animal that you wanted to photograph and maybe you got a little bit too close?
I will tell you of a time, I don't remember of an animal, no, but I do remember a time to where I think I was in Tennessee and I was And I photographed, I've been all over the United States. I got about five states left to professionally photograph from a nature and wildlife standpoint. But I was around, I think I was in Tennessee, and I had the purpose of looking for waterfalls. And then this waterfall, it was a nice one. So I was there, and you know, it's maybe getting like 4 o'clock, and it could get dark maybe at 6:30. I don't remember exactly, maybe 7. And, you know, it said it was like, I don't know, maybe like 3/4 of a mile down the creek before you get there. I have never been there. I really have no, I don't feel bad about it. There's no bad feelings. It's like, I feel like I'll just walk, I'll find the waterfall, and great, I'll film it. It'll be great. But for whatever reason, I happened to maybe walk like 1/4 of a mile or 1/2 of a mile, and I wasn't seeing it. And I was kind of aware, like you said, what dangers do you look out for? Mm-hmm. Well, it gets dark. They could close the park. I could get lost. Those things kind of started to set in, and to where I didn't want to waste my time, like just get up and go. I probably should have, because I was kind of uncertain. But I said, you know, I'm just going to kind of risk it. And it ended up working out. But I was actually kind of scared because it was like getting dark. The terrain was not that good either. So mm-hmm. it wasn't like I was just walking down a creek to find this waterfall. And it was just so peaceful and even and easy. And I could hear people. Like, I felt like if I could hear people maybe 1/2 mile away or 1/4 mile away, I'd be fine. Because I'm like, okay, I got a short walk. I'll see the waterfall. Great. It's just up there. So, and I was seeing in the creek, there were places that were really steep and rocks, and I could see like kind of rapids, things like that. And, you know, it's very dangerous. You don't get enough water. You walk the wrong way and you're not looking. You could get trapped there. You could drown. And,
wow.
You know, there could be bear in there. There could be snakes in there. And, mm-hmm. and I'm really cautious anyway. There was a lot of rock. And so it's one of the only times that I kind of got a little afraid. And there happened to be two people that, you know, came walking, not toward me or anything, but they were there, and it seemed like they kind of maybe knew the terrain, like maybe they'd been there. And I had to stop them and ask them and say, hey, you know, I'm a little kind of afraid right now. Can I right. just, can I just walk with you? Like, you, sure. I don't have to be right with you, but just to see somebody. And they right. said, oh, it's just up the, you know, up the creek about 1/2 mile. And so that was kind of a relief. And I kind of felt that I would get there. But that was just like kind of a time to where it didn't feel good. And I about left, and I'd have wasted kind of the whole day because I set out the whole day for that specific waterfall.
Right. Can you tell our viewers, like, in wildlife, it requires planning, obviously. And there's a great detail that goes in it. Can you tell our audience, what exactly do you look for when you're out there looking for a wildlife shot? What are some of the elements and some of the things that you're looking for? Like, I think the area, the trees, or tell us like what's a good area to look for, and what do you look for when you're looking for a good wildlife shot?
In the past couple of years, I've looked for waterfalls.
Nice.
And that's a planned shot, and that's the most accurate that I can think of.
All animals.
And that is where once I've planned it out, I do have a destination.
Yeah.
And so once I get there, you know, hopefully, and I try to look for the weather. And hopefully mm-hmm. it's not raining, or I really wouldn't maybe go through with that time or that day. And then that would work out good for me to where I get there and pretty much I'm going to have a good day there. The weather's pretty good. And then I go from there. That would be the time that I've planned the most
mm-hmm.
and make the most of it once I get there.
Cool. You ever work with drones, or have you ever worked with them? Seems like they're pretty popular.
I have not worked with drones.
Okay.
I think they're very cool.
Yeah.
As far as having more of a downward angle and having more freedom, something I would probably work with in the future, but I have not worked with them yet.
Sure. Today we're speaking with Larkin Fourkiller, photographer, entrepreneur. Larkin, do you have any advice for new and upcoming photographers breaking into the business?
You better love it with your whole heart. But there's different ways to go about it. If you like it as a hobby, then great. If you like it, you know, something, income revenue on the side, great. And if you like it full time, that's great. But I would just say, you know, with anything in life and photography and the arts, it's just, you just have to love it with your whole heart. You just have to love it. You have to work. You have to want to be there, because you're not going to like it if you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And the animals in the nature will not, they will not just be cheap and give to you for free. It's like you have to have a certain spirit. You have to have a certain calmness and a certain appreciation and a certain love when you go out there. And when you go out there with that, you're in the same world. And when you're in that same world, then you can visit, you can admire, you can photograph, you can see, and everything will open up for you because you're hearing nature's noise, which is quiet, but it's the important noise. So love what you do. Go out there with the purest, most intentional heart, care, and it will reward you back a hundredfold.
Nice, nice. Larkin, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
You can get a hold of me on LinkedIn and or under Larkin, Four Killer, FourKiller.
Nice, nice. Want to let you know that I'm happy to have you on the show today and learn a lot about photography. Things that you mentioned today I didn't know about, so I'm great, great listener and happy to learn.
Yeah, it was a great time to speak with Gary Trapper Wilcox.
Yeah.
And Larry, as a photographer and for you having me on the show, I'm very appreciative of life and of people. And I'm very appreciative that you two would take the time to learn and to ask questions. Mm-hmm. And it really, when I look at things, it's about visiting. And I'm happy that we all three had the chance to visit.
Nice, nice. I like the way you put that. Stopping by our house.
So cool, man.
Yeah. Well, thank you for stopping by today. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show.
All right. Well,
thank you, Larkin, for stopping by today and sharing with us your story. It has been great. Thank you so much.
Yeah. I'll have to get you back on.
Thank you. You too. Bye.
Yeah. Take care. Stay safe and safe travels out there.
All righty.
Thank you for tuning in to Indigenous in the News and supporting us and our entrepreneurs. Indigenous in the News has been produced by Larry Kay. Our assistant producer is Paul Salvatore. Our theme music is composed by Lenny Long. Today's show has been recorded at the Two Buffalo Studios in Bradenton, Florida. National Native News is provided by Native Voice One with Antonio Gonzalez. Come visit us at indigenousinmusicandarts.org to hear all of our past shows and learn all about the great programs that we provide. Until next time, from all of us here at Indigenous in the News, have yourself a wonderful week and safe journeys. Indigenous in the News is a production of Indigenous in Music and Arts.